This is the Downeast Journal on Public Radio East. You've heard the adage, Virginia is for lovers. That may not be the case, according to a recently published study examining how people's relationships and relational style vary from state to state. North Carolina made it into the top 10 as a place for positive relationships. Surprisingly, our northern neighbor, Virginia, ranked 19th for states with lowest attachment anxiety and 23rd for states with lowest attachment avoidance. This week, I spoke with William Chopik, an assistant professor in psychology at Michigan State University and one of the authors of the study.
Started the study last summer, actually, and, you know, it started out with the motivation that a lot of people have these sort of stereotypes about places. So New York is full of really anxious people. Californians are more laid back. And there was a bunch of ways in which people characterize places in terms of relationships. So Philadelphia is the city of brotherly love. Hershey, Pennsylvania is the sweetest place on earth. Virginia is for lovers, was the title of the paper. So we kind of sought out to see, are any of these sort of phrases accurate in describing the places and the people that live in those places?
How did you collect your data? How did you do your survey?
So actually, it was a website sponsored by the University of Pennsylvania. And basically, they offered a bunch of different psychological questionnaires. So people could go to this site and take a survey, and they would actually get feedback on their personality. And people were just generally really interested in that. So tons and tons of people went to the site and filled out questions about their relationships and how happy they are and, you know, what they look for in life, what they find most meaningful in their life. And we give them feedback, and then we ask, hey, is it okay if we, you know, use your data for research? And in this particular study, over 120,000 people said yes. So we definitely benefited from people's generosity, and plenty of people from North Carolina were nice enough to let us use their data.
And what was surprising about the studies is Virginia actually finished mid-pack. There were other states that were in the top spot. Can you tell me more about your findings?
Yeah, so in some sense, it did confirm some of these stereotypes. But yeah, so like you say, Virginia, who has this motto that they're the exemplar for what it means to be loved and affectionate, they weren't that way. Yeah, we generally found that people in the mountainous regions were what's called avoidant, so they generally were more self-sufficient. They didn't care as much about close relationship. And then people in the northeastern and mid-Atlantic regions were generally higher in anxiety. So these are people that really worry about close relationships. They worry about their partner being around the next day. So they're sort of the stereotypical, like, Woody Allen type when you think about his approach to relationships.
According to the study, Mississippi, Utah, and Wisconsin basically tied for first place as best states for positive relationships. And not far down from that was North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
Where
yeah.
did North Carolina rank?
So it was reverse scored. So they were around the 41st in each. So, they were around 9 and 8.
Okay. So just to clarify, North Carolina has the 9th lowest attachment anxiety rate and the 8th lowest attachment avoidance rate.
Yeah, so they were pretty secure in their relationships, which I think is a good thing.
Now, you were talking about the different stereotypes. Are there any stereotypes for North Carolina, and do we kind of reflect those?
I don't think so. I mean, you guys appear to be doing really well, and the state offers quite a lot. So there's, you know, really great universities where people can seek out educational opportunities, but then also has a lot of natural beauty. And we find that states that generally have those kind of things, so a wealth of opportunities for couples to, say, go on romantic nature walks, but then also be a hub of, knowledge. So states that have a lot to offer apparently have more diversity in relationships, and then that appears to be a good thing that we're finding.
Were there any other surprising results of your study?
I think one thing that was really cool was that we then linked these scores to census data. So we looked at marriage rates and divorce rates and, you know, mortality and how much a state volunteers and, you know, how big the household sizes tend to be, how often do people live alone. And we found that that was actually correlated with people's approaches to relationships. So, you know, places like North Carolina that are really secure, those are the states where there's actually more people married, or that there's fewer people living alone, or there's more people volunteering their time to help other people. So one really surprising thing is that it bled out into a bunch of other behaviors.
So from this study, all the people that are spending Valentine's Day alone, North Carolina may be a good place to find that true love.
Yeah, I wouldn't go that far, but at least, Valentine's Day in North Carolina sounds very lovely.
Okay, fair enough. William Chopik is an assistant professor in psychology at Michigan State University. Thanks so much for speaking with me.
Great, thanks, you too.
On Valentine's Day, the Southern Gentleman Barbershop Chorus will be delivering singing valentines to sweethearts across Craven County. Today on the Down East Journal, Mac McKee speaks with member Brian Giersch about the annual tradition.
How long has the Southern Gentleman Barbershop Chorus been together, Brian?
This is our 25th anniversary. The chorus was organized in 1992, and we are just absolutely delighted to be celebrating our silver anniversary this year.
You're based in New Bern, so do you stay primarily in this area, or have you performed in other places around eastern North Carolina, Brian?
Most of our work is in New Bern and immediate surrounding area, but we have done performances out in Kinston, up in Little Washington, and we've gone down to Havelock. Our quartet actually has gone down to the beach.
Now, how many people are in the barbershop chorus? I understand you have a lot of members, so you can split up into separate quartets.
We have in excess of 30 guys, probably 35 guys on the roster. We probably put 25, 28 guys on the risers when we have performances. But within the chorus for Valentine's Day, we will break out four quartets. So we'll have 16 guys on the road for Valentine's, delivering singing Valentine's to families.
There's no one to talk with all by myself. No one to walk with, but I'm happy on the shelf. Hey, misbehaving, I'm saving my love for you. Wonderful you,
and I
know for certain, know what I love. I'm through with flirting, it's just you I'm thinking of. Hey, misbehaving.
Do people kind of come and go, or has the group stayed pretty much the same over the years?
No, absolutely. We fluctuate in our membership. We've just recently added seven guys to the chorus, probably in the last 4 or 5 months. And we lose a couple of guys who've transitioned to other locations or age out or have family or illness issues. And we've been very fortunate to add more guys recently than we've lost. So we're pleased to be growing in numbers presently.
Valentine's Day is an especially busy time for you. Now, February 14th, you'll be surprising sweethearts and serenading them with love songs. When did the singing Valentine's tradition begin?
I would imagine for the New Bern community, singing Valentine's were delivered our very first year of existence in 1992, because it's really a function of the Barbershop Society, which is nationwide, and it even has chapters in other countries. But probably every barbershop chapter in the United States does singing Valentine deliveries. So it's a tradition of the barbershop world.
Now, how many singing Valentines do you do each year?
If we could fully optimize our four quartets, we could do probably 80 deliveries in a day. Our guys start very early in the morning, and they can go till early in the evening, and doing one every half hour, we could probably get 20 in for each quartet.
Let me call you, sweetheart. I'm in love with you. Let me hear you whisper that you love me too.
Do people request songs, or do you pick them?
We'll go in with two love songs that are just lovely, very traditional. We also have a beautiful rose, personalized card with the message from the individual who is asking us to deliver the singing Valentines. We do a photograph and then email the photograph to the person who is also responsible for the delivery. If someone were to request a different song, it would have to be from our repertoire, and the quartet would have to be comfortable in performing it.
Now, of all the years you've been together, you said 25 years, is there a particular performance that sticks out in your mind as being really special?
Every single guy who's done this over the years probably has remarkable memories. But I'd like to share, too, if you had the time.
Certainly.
Our quartet had on what we refer to as Military Day, where we do courtesy Valentines at no charge to military families. We had gone into a home in Havelock, and the mother in the household invited us in. There were two little children. And strangely, on February the 14th was a Christmas tree, and it was lit and decorated with Christmas presents underneath. We did the Singing Valentine's presentation and then had to ask, why was there a Christmas tree with Christmas presents still under it? And the answer was that her husband was deployed, was coming home tomorrow, and she and the children had waited for 10 weeks to have Christmas when her husband came home. And it just gives me goosebumps even to tell that story today. Another one, very briefly, very elderly couple living in our community invited us in, and we were singing in front of the fireplace, and he was taking a video camera of us. And afterwards explained that his wife was suffering from dementia and that occasionally she had a clear mind, and what he hoped to do is when her mind cleared, he would play the video for her so she could be reminded of the Valentines and how he felt about her. So it's just remarkable things that we experience every time we go out.
Light of my life, my darling, I love you, I love you.
Proceeds from the Singing Valentine support charitable giving of the Southern Gentlemen Barbershop Chorus. What are the nonprofits that the chorus contributes to?
We give money to Mercy Clinic and the Coastal Women's Shelter. They are our favorites of ours and important functions within the community.
Brian, thank you so much for being our guest today on the Down East Journal.
Glad to be here.
For more information about the Southern Gentlemen Barbershop Chorus, check out our website at publicradioeast.org, or you can call 252-288-9132. And happy Valentine's Day.
Let me call you, sweetheart. Be my Valentine.
This is Lisa Rayburn, Horticulture Agent with Onslow County Cooperative Extension, here with this week's edition of The Garden Journal. Just in case you don't remember, Valentine's Day is next week, and that got me thinking, have you ever wondered why red roses are the symbol of Valentine's Day? Why not chrysanthemums? They'd certainly be cheaper. Or white or yellow roses. Well, the reason lies in the language of flowers. As every gardener knows, flowers have a language of their own, but this language has been formalized and used to communicate thoughts and emotions for centuries. The language of flowers, also known as floriography, has been around for thousands of years. The ancient Greeks, Romans, Egyptians, and Chinese all included flower symbolism in their writing. During the Middle Ages, floriography allowed people to communicate without writing or speaking. Flowers were used to declare love, affection, and intentions. The height of flower communication probably occurred during the Victorian era. During this time, intimate emotions that could not be spoken out loud were conveyed with flowers. Many small handbooks were produced that described the meanings of various flowers, but depending on the location and author, the meaning of a flower could vary from one guide to another. So when you research flower symbolism today, you will notice that a flower may have different meanings attached to it. Red roses symbolize desire and romantic love, so it has become the traditional symbol of Valentine's Day. However, red chrysanthemums and heliotrope mean I love you, and forget-me-nots mean true love. Other flowers that express love include red tulips, which signify perfect love, coreopsis, which means love at first sight, and phlox, which means our hearts are united. For the shy, gardenia means I love you in secret. Maybe this is why it winds up planted under so many bedroom windows. And violets mean I return your love. Symbolism is not only tied to the flowers or plants themselves, but also to the color. When looking at roses, different colors are attributed with different meanings. While red roses symbolize desire and romantic love, Pink roses mean perfect happiness or please believe me. These may come in useful for someone trying to dig themselves out of a tricky relationship mess. White roses mean innocence and purity, while yellow roses stand for jealousy. If you want to spice things up a bit, orange or coral roses indicate desire. So if you haven't already ordered a bouquet for your sweetie, maybe there's room for more than just roses in the bouquet.
Next week is Valentine's Day, but February is dedicated to Black History Month, which recognizes the contributions of the Black community in shaping this country and the world. The Greenville Museum of Art has an exhibit on display, Perceptions and Recognitions, which highlights African Americans from Eastern North Carolina and their personal stories. The museum commissioned world-renowned photographer and Eastern North Carolina native Burke Uzzell for the exhibit. His career has taken him around the world, capturing historic events from the first Woodstock Music and Arts Festival to the funeral of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Chris Thomas spoke with him at his studio in Wilson and has this.
Burke Uzzell's creative space is a bohemian's dream come true. It's tucked away at a corner of a main thoroughfare and a side road, but the doors are painted bright red. There's room enough for work, leisure, and rest. And it's old. Very old.
They sold Hudson's and Essex cars. Essex cars had spoke wheels and were made in 1913. And I have one of the spoke wheels over there as a souvenir. And then they made caskets in here. It's been a florist. They've been bicycle shops. Men's clothing was a Texaco gas station for a while.
His studio and much of his life work, his archives, are on the bottom floor. The walls are brick and sparse, save for some large prints of his more recent work. Copies of those prints are on display at the Greenville Museum of Art as part of its latest exhibit. The subject? Black people of Eastern North Carolina. The 25 photos feature local residents, including Judge Wendy Hazelton and Dr. Alma Hobbs, former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Administration at the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
African Americans are beautiful people to photograph. The emotion, they're emotive, they respond, they're available emotionally in a conversation. It's been a great, great thing to learn over the years, all my life, and that's been my experience.
The exhibit is titled Perceptions and Recognitions, and its purpose is to shed light on a community often found at the margins.
This is not a preachy kind of exhibition. It's simply offering very clear and poignant and poetic documentation of very beautiful people doing great things and just being themselves.
Uzzell grew up in Dunn, North Carolina, about 40 miles southeast of Raleigh, as Jim Crow began its violent, gradual death. Through his father's work with the town government and his own paper route, Uzzell saw how things were on the other side of the tracks.
I had a paper route, and I would be in and out of all the neighborhoods, even doing that very early in the morning. So it was very clear to me that it was inequality was a given, financially and socially.
Appropriately enough, his first assignment for Life magazine nearly 60 years ago involved visiting the home of an up-and-coming minister from Atlanta, Martin Luther King Jr. He'd take his photo again about a decade later, while the civil rights leader laid in his casket following his assassination. That photo, and others chronicling the aftermath of the shooting, are on display at the Greenville Museum and in Uzzell's studio, but they almost weren't taken at all.
I was on an airplane, and my wife at the time heard he had been killed, met me at the airport gate, handed me a plane ticket to Memphis, and a bag of film and saying, Dr. Martin Luther King has just been killed. I knew you'd want to be in Memphis. The next flight leaves in 20 minutes, and the gate is just down there. So off I went.
Much of Uzzell's career has been on his own terms, to some degree. Apart from a brief stint with the News and Observer as a teenager, he's made his living freelancing. Through the lens of his camera, he saw the 1960s unfold. He took his most famous photo at Woodstock, an intimate moment between two people, wrapped in a blanket as the sun rose during the festival's final day. It would become the official Woodstock album cover, and Uzzell said it wouldn't have happened without a little help from his friends. Many of them were also freelancers, and while they were taking pictures of the acts on stage, Uzzell said he was milling with the spectators on Max Yasgur's farm.
And they would say, well, the editor wants us to stay here and be sure to get Jimi Hendrix or get a Ravi Shankar or what have you. And I would say, well, all that's fine, and I do hope you fulfill your responsibilities to your editor. And meanwhile, would you loan me a few rolls of color film? Because I didn't have enough film to shoot all the stuff that I was seeing. And so actually the cover of the Woodstock album was taken on borrowed color film.
He also saw the other side of the decade, riots and urban decay at home, and napalm bombs in Southeast Asia. Uzzel said his favorite assignments were the ones where he captured the lives of everyday people, especially in his neck of the woods.
I would take it upon myself to go photograph in the Deep South routinely and hang out with people, sharecroppers, black sharecroppers that would have to feed their kids large sandwiches daily because that's all they had money for. So though they weren't riots, they certainly led me to a very clear understanding of what life could be, what could be about in these arenas.
Over the past few years, as class, political, and race-based tensions have reached new heights, parallels between the 1960s and today have been made. And like in the days of inner-city riots and open talk of revolution, Uzzel says misconceptions about the black community are prevalent.
I'd like to say that everything is all perfect and wonderful and shiny, new and great, but it's not so. I see a lot of indication of a racism, even amongst friends, where there's this kind of sly insinuation that's maybe even not clearly articulated, but you see it in behavior, in the way people will seat themselves in a restaurant or behave themselves in general, that racism has not been eradicated.
Color and shadow feature prominently in Uzzel's new exhibit, bright, vibrant hues, especially depicting church attendees in their Sunday best, are placed in contrast with stark, colorless backdrops. In one photo, the subject's face isn't seen, only the markings of a past life. Another photo was shot in a cemetery, a woman standing by gravestones of ancestors born slaves and laid to rest as citizens. These are the perceptions and recognitions of individuals living in eastern North Carolina, a small sampling of more than 36 million people across the United States. I'm Chris Thomas.
Next week, there's a networking event happening at the coast bringing together marine and environmental scientists and educators. In its fifth year, SIREN, an acronym for Scientific Research and Education Network, is aimed at building a relationship between coastal scientists and local teachers. Kindergarten through 12th grade teachers who attend the workshop can receive free lesson plans based on North Carolina standards and focused on local research happening at our coast.
They've got some great information. A lot of them have really good data, and that's what our kids need. They need real science in the classroom.
Miriam Sutton is a science teacher at Moorhead City Middle School. She was in attendance at last year's SIREN event, which drew over 120 educators from across the state and 40 researchers from Duke University, East Carolina, the Institute of Marine Sciences, and NC State. This year's event should be even bigger. So far, more than 45 scientists will attend, and 100 teachers are signed up for the workshop. PhD student at the Institute of Marine Sciences, Martin Benavides, is helping organize the event. He says grade-appropriate lesson plans will be available on topics like water quality, local stormwater research, and invasive species along our coast.
Another thing that we emphasize to these researchers is, in addition to coming up with the activity that should be hands-on and engaging, you know, they need to be able to justify the why. Why should they be teaching this lesson to their students? That's an important thing that, you know, every teacher needs to get across to their students in order to get them engaged.
Benavides was a high school teacher for 4 years in New York City before moving to Eastern North Carolina. He says it was a challenge to connect students with ongoing research and breaking discoveries being made. He hopes the SIREN event will help facilitate a transfer of information from the laboratory to the classroom.
In addition, you know, there's also a hope that as these educators and researchers start to network, that they'll develop relationships that can then translate to in-classroom experiences where scientists maybe come into the classroom and teach the students themselves.
Benavides was a guest in Sutton's classroom where he talked about his research using drones to track sharks off our coast.
And the kids just, I mean, that totally lit up. I mean, I can say it all day long, and I can show them pictures of what these guys are doing in the field, but it's not the same. That's when they're actually there talking to them about what they're doing and how it's done.
Sutton has had researchers from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, Duke Marine Lab, and the Institute of Marine Sciences teach lesson plans to her class. The goal of the Siren Workshop is to encourage teachers to learn more about local marine and environmental research and make connections with scientists that could translate into educational opportunities for their students. The event takes place next Thursday, February 16th, at the North Carolina Aquarium at Pine Knoll Shores from 5:30 to 8 p.m. Lesson plans and other resources are free for teachers. For more information, go to the ENC events calendar at publicradioeast.org. Thanks for listening to the Downeast Journal. If you have questions, comments, or ideas for features, drop us a line at publicradioeast.org. Have a great weekend and happy Valentine's Day.